Bob Willis, a cricketer and a gentleman. If you are of a certain age like me, you will remember a golden summer of sport. You will remember Bob Willis as being an integral part of one of the most fabulous English cricket victories in history. Following his passing in 2019, tributes to Bob Willis came flooding in from every major news outlet and from every major figure in and outside the industry. Willis was one of England's greatest fast bowlers, making 90 test appearances, playing for Surrey and Warwickshire, and making an international debut age 21. A new book is called Bob Willis, A Cricketer and a Gentleman. It's edited, it's written with Mike Dixon. Delighted to be joining me on the line from the UK. Mike himself. Mike, good morning to you.
Hello, Giles.
Thank you for joining me this morning. Bob truly was a figure that was legendary in his time. Fast and furious, his bowling style was described as, but he was so much more than just being a demon bowler.
Well, he certainly had a big hinterland in his life, and he was someone you could, who was very happy to discuss anything but cricket. But he obviously loved cricket, but he could talk about a very broad musical tastes. He was pretty well travelled. He was a good cook. He was interested in politics, interested in a lot of other sports. And as the book chapter titles tell you, he had absolute obsession with Bob Dylan. But his musical taste was extremely wide ranging. He was also very into Wagner as well. So, I mean, to put it briefly, he was a man of many parts.
And describe a little bit of his impact on the game of cricket, how he rose up through the ranks, and of course the becoming captain of England in 81, and also obviously part of the fabulous and the fabled Ashes victory.
Well, I think for cricket aficionados, what was interesting about the span of his career is that when he first started playing for England, and as you rightly said, he was a sort of surprise call-up at the age of 21 to an Ashes tour. In that era of cricket was still pretty much the post-war era of when cricketers were fairly impoverished. The game had limited media coverage, etc. And really, by the time he retired playing for England in 1984, the whole sport had really transformed into what is we're more familiar with now, which had gone through the Kerry Packer era. And become this sort of commercial juggernaut in which players could earn a lot of money. And his career really began in one completely different era and ended in another.
And I mean, if you look at what made him so special as a cricketer, was it the accuracy of the bowling? Was it because people talk about cricket being a mental game, especially sort of a 5-day test? Did he have the mental toughness and the mental sort of wild guile to bring to his game?
Well, he was definitely he was a very fierce competitor. There's no doubt about that. Very focused. But I think really, I suppose what was unusual about him is that it's pretty unusual really for England to produce genuinely fast bowlers. And he, from his considerable height, 6'6", he was a rare breed who could actually bowl the ball extremely fast and make batsmen uncomfortable. And he could get uncommon lift off even a fairly dead pitch. In the book there's a foreword by Ian Botham, and one of the comments that he makes was that when he came into the team, something he worked out within a couple of overs was that if you remember, Botham was a great slip catcher, was that he needed to stand probably two paces back from where he normally stood, just because the ball would fly off that much quicker from a Willis delivery. So he was unusual in that he was an out-and-out pace bowler.
And also, one of the things you talk about spanning the ages, as you were, the differences in cricket between then and now. But if you look at the collection of players that were in that Ashes squad for the England, you've got Mike Brearley, you've got Gatting, you've got Gower, you've got Botham. They were a disparate set of personalities that perhaps we don't have so much of in the modern game.
Well, I think that's true. Generally, you could apply this to any sport, is that young players coming through now tend to be a bit more institutionalized in that they've been through you know, professional academy systems from a pretty young age, which obviously wasn't the case in those days. So they tended to be slightly more rounded personalities with a bit more sort of going on off the pitch. I mean, it's also worth saying that obviously in those days there was much less live sport on TV and much fewer channels. And cricket particularly, you know, they were extremely well-known mainstream personalities, really, as the sort of people that you've mentioned, in a way that sadly perhaps now even someone like Ben Stokes, who's, you know, by far and away the biggest star of this England team, they could probably still walk down some streets relatively unrecognised, which was unthinkable in those days. I mean, Ian Botham, as you probably recall, was in the 80s. I mean, he really was a sort of national icon, and that really wouldn't happen these days.
And I remember being around, you know, during that test, and literally the whole country stopping with the Headingley test.
Well, yeah, I mean, you hear tales, and I think Mike Atherton makes a reference to it in a piece that he's contributed, you know, walking, I think he was in the shops in Manchester, and people sort of gathered around TVs outside Rumbelows or you know, electrical stores that sold TVs. And it was a sort of national moment where you can, that particular test you're referring to, Headingley 81, where people can sort of tend to remember where they were at the time watching it. And actually, when they won, the stock market, in fact, went up several percentage points. You know, it sort of seemed to lift the mood of the whole nation.
And the strange thing was, of course, that Willis wasn't originally picked for the match, was he? They thought he'd lost a bit of form.
Well, he was actually, his form was waning and he'd suffered a lot of long-term injuries. And B, the week prior, he'd had a heavy chest cold, and they'd rather thought that, you know, he was going to be surplus to requirements. But then he told them, he said, look, I'm going to get over this. It's only just a cold. And actually what happened was, in those days, that you, if you were picked for England, a letter was sent to your county, and Mike Hendrick of Derbyshire was due to be picked, and they actually, in the Derbyshire office, intercepted the letter telling him he was going to be picked. So Bob shouldn't really have been playing at all.
Marvellous stuff. And what was he like as a, because he went on then to you know, the country rejoiced, etc. Botham sort of took most of the glory, but Willis is obviously still remembered fondly for it. What was he like as a captain then, when he led his country?
Well, I think it was a very, very unusual for, and it's still considered very unusual for, a fast bowler to be a captain. I mean, I think he did admit to me several times that, you know, he wasn't a tactical genius probably, but I think he was quite a good delegator. And also, I mean, he very much led by example. And I think one of the weaknesses, probably, if one's fair about it, was that he expected the same very high professional standards off other players that he set for himself. And occasionally he would be a bit too lax in enforcing those, I think probably because he trusted the players too much. So he was never a great disciplinarian, but he just kind of led over the top, I suppose.
After, when he retired in 84, he eventually found his way up into the commentator strokes summarizers booth. Seemed to be a natural place for his wit and his descriptions.
Well, he certainly carved out a niche towards the end of his broadcasting career, and his life indeed, as this rather trenchant, acerbic assessor of the game in a show that was known as The Verdict, and then it actually changed its name to The Debate. But it was a very long, again, you know, he spanned a very interesting era in broadcasting, because you know, when Sky revolutionised the coverage of cricket when they first got involved in 1990, he joined in 91 and was there really up to his death. And of course, cricket, you know, has benefited financially anyway, massively from the Sky investment, although the counter argument to that, I suppose, is that there are less people watching the game than there were back then.
And so when it came to putting this book together, because obviously we had his, you know, he passed away last year, I mean, how do you start putting a book like this together? And I believe you worked also with Bob's brother as well.
I became friends with Bob when I used to ghost his column in the Daily Mail, and we actually lived very near each other in London. So that arrangement came and went, but we remained good friends, and we'd been actually working on the sort of prototype of a new autobiography of him before his health sadly went downhill last summer, summer 2019. And then when he passed away, the publisher who we'd been talking to actually came back to his family and said, look, I'd really like to publish a sort of biography stroke tribute book to him. And I was, because I knew him so well, and I also had some of the information already in the bank, I was asked to do the sort of biographical section of the book. And but it's not a kind of conventional biography in terms of it's just sort of 100,000 words of detailing his life. There's a lot of contributions from other cricketers to it, and sort of some of the great highlights of his career. And I have to say, it's been, and this says, by the way, far more about him than it does about me, but it has been selling remarkably successfully at the moment.
Well, yes, and indeed, and all the proceeds are going to Prostate Cancer UK, aren't they? So, I mean, it is in a good cause.
Well, that is one of the byproducts, yeah, is that it is going to be raising a large sum of money. And it's, I mean, it was number 3 on the Sunday Times bestsellers list this week. So, with every book sold, there's going to be more money raised for the cause.
And I mean, when you compile something like this, and when something like this is edited and compiled, I mean, I can't imagine there'd be much of a problem getting people to reminisce and to bring not only the cricketing highlights, but as you mentioned before at the beginning, you know, he had a wide range of interests. He could discuss and discourse at length on a variety of topics.
It certainly wasn't a problem getting people to contribute. I mean, the biggest problem we had actually was the time frame. I mean, doing these books is actually quite a long technical process. We only really fired the starting gun on it in sort of early March. So it was quite an effort to sort of pull it all together. And obviously everyone working from home really at that stage because of the lockdown, etc. I must say, in terms of getting sort of, people like Mike Atherton, say, or Ian Botham to cooperate, that wasn't a problem at all. Because he was actually, although I think the public sometimes had sort of mixed opinions of him or sometimes his views, he was an extremely popular figure within the game.
I mean, but do you think that in an age of, 24/7 coverage and what we have in cricket seemingly on the TV every day, and as you said, the players seem to have been through academies or something, that you need a controversial character? And as I said before, cricket has always been a thinking man's pastime, thinking man's sport. And so you need somebody to engage rather than just bringing you sort of facts and trivia.
Well, I think that's true in any sport, really, is that I think people have tired a bit of kind of bland punditry. But he was a bit of a trail. I mean, his sort of philosophy with his analysis and punditry was that he would try and really talk to the viewers in the same way that he would talk to a mate in the pub, and it was very unvarnished what he used to say about people. And occasionally he went over the top, I think. And he knew that. He had to write a few letters of apology. He sort of almost pioneered the kind of giving it to people pretty straight. But he was actually like that as a person. He didn't really suffer fools gladly, and he generally, he did what he said on the tin, really, when it came to his opinions.
And what do you think his opinion would be about the Bob Willis Trophy?
I think quietly he'd have been very flattered. You mean about it being named after
him?
Yeah,
indeed, and the format as well.
Yeah, I mean, he was actually very much someone who was always looking at ways to try and sort of improve and spice up domestic cricket. He actually felt sort of very deeply about cricket and the whole workings of it, but he was happy to talk till the cows came home about his ideas for it. I mean, but I think obviously this has been a kind of emergency measure, hasn't it, really, to try and salvage something of the season. But I mean, I think he'd have been very flattered for it was named after him, and probably would have applauded the fact they have managed to get some kind of cricket on.
I mean, we said before, do you think that players like Bob Willis and Peter, you know, and his ilk, we're going to... There's a lack of them now, because as we move towards, you know, you've got the Indian Super Leagues and cricket's 24/7, and the perhaps more thoughtful players are going to be scarce and scarce to be found?
Well, I think the nature of the beast in all sports is that, you know, the money now at stake is that players have become far more professional. And I guess there are fewer sort of inverted commas characters around, which has been a byproduct of that. I mean, in a technical sense as well, it's pretty, you know, bowling fast is very tough on the body. Players now are looking to have long careers because they can make so much money. And so it's getting harder and harder to find out-and-out quick bowlers. I mean, Bob had loads of operations on his knees and stuff like that, just the sheer pounding that he gave them. But I think, as you rightly say, with the... With all the financial opportunities of limited over cricket, I think there's more and more of a reluctance to people to bowl genuinely quick.
What memories do you take or do you cherish most about Bob? Because you said he didn't suffer fools gladly. He had a wide range of interests. He was a Dylan fan, to put it mildly. What's the memory that makes you smile?
I think probably from my personal point of view, it was just sort of sitting in a pub or a restaurant, chewing the cud about, you know, he liked, he was very into his wine, by the way. I didn't mention that, but he was, his views on wine were almost as strong as they were about cricket, and he loved real ale. He actually just loved sitting in the pub talking, and I just really enjoyed his company and his dry wit and his sort of take on the human condition were often very amusing and perceptive at the same time. So, you know, in terms of a sort of friendship, that was kind of the thing that I think actually, if you ask most people who knew him well, I think that's the kind of thing they would, I mean, he was a great organizer as well. He loved sort of organizing outings to restaurants and things like that. And I think that's the kind of thing that most of his friends will miss about him.
The book is called Bob Willis, A Cricketer and a Gentleman. It is by Mike Dixon, amongst others. Mike, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, I know it's out by Hodder and Stoughton. Where can they find you on the World Wide Web?
Well, probably the best place to look is there's a Twitter account called Bob Willis Legacy, and that kind of has the details. I think the prostate cancer website as well also has some stuff on it, but I mean it's kind of readily available from the usual places.
Indeed, it'll be available as a virtual download as well as an ebook from our website as well. The book is called Bob Willis, A Cricketer and a Gentleman. It's out now. Mike Dixon, thank you so much for your time today.
Very nice talking to you.